I love the chutzpah of publishing a book and, you know, providing a bio, right? Believe it or not, there's a bio there on that flap that goes like this. Edward L. Greenstein is Professor Emeritus of Bible at Bar-Ilan University and a prolific world-renowned scholar in many areas of biblical and ancient Near Eastern studies. Enough said. Just beautiful. I'm sure that some of you are here not only because of the translator, annotator, author, but because of the book that has been translated and its significance, the Book of Job. Raise your hand if you've ever suffered. So you probably have reason to be here. And the only thing I will add by way of introduction is that each translation obviously is an interpretation. It's something to sit down with and dive into and learn from and find yourself challenged and to challenge back. And there's always reason to sit down with a good and important and very difficult book and challenge yourself once again. 20 years ago, this institution had the privilege of celebrating the publication of an earlier translation of the Book of Job, annotated and introduced by our own Raymond Shenlin. So to sit down 20 years later and to be challenged to study the Book of Job once again is just a marvelous opportunity. We're just going to get a small taste of that tonight. Copies of the book will be for sale after the presentation and period of questions for a mere $15. And without anything further, let me introduce Professor Ed Greenstein.
Do I need to rip this or it'll pick me up? It'll pick me up. No, okay, good. Okay, well, thank you very much, David. It's really wonderful to be here. This was an institution that I studied in and grew in and taught in, for many years, and it's been home away from home for all the years that I've been in Israel. And I'm very glad to, to be here again. I'm also very glad, to see, family members and old friends, some friends even who have been my friends even longer than you might imagine who are here tonight, and I appreciate that. And colleagues, and I see even a colleague from my department in Israel is here. I'm very glad to be here with all of you, and I want to just share, some of my thoughts on what I tried to do in this translation of Job. I have a little introduction. Okay, translation, and we'll need the handout. Handout is to be used. We're studying together. Translation is at best an art of compromise. Right? It's like taking cargo. To translate means to carry across, and it's like putting cargo in a boat that can only hold so much, and you want to get it across the river, but you can't convey everything. So you have to make serious choices. What am I going to preserve? What am I going to try to convey? And what am I going to have to leave behind on the other shore? And sometimes the task is quite daunting and you have to leave almost everything behind. And sometimes you can try to convey, more than just the basics. In my translation, I tried to convey a little more than just the basics, but the main thing was to convey what I think is the most basic sense. And I'll explain that in a minute. The great Jewish thinker of the early 20th century, Franz Rosenzweig, said that the act of translation can only be performed by someone who knows in advance that it's impossible, right? So I, taking it upon myself, right, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to truly, deeply translate Job, but it's only through an effort of translation, as compromised or as faux as it may be, that one can make sense of any foreign text. That's because apart from a purely mechanical translation, which takes little in the way of tone, nuance, rhetoric, etc., etc., into account, The act of translation entails an attempt to make sense. For me, the project of translating Job demanded first and above all a commitment to make sense of each and every word and phrase, each and every passage, each and every argument, and to tease out and throw into relief those motifs, topics, images, and themes that I became convinced were most crucial to achieving a true understanding of the book. My best teachers, one of whom I'm proud to, and pleased to see is here tonight, Professor David Marcus, right? My best teachers had always insisted that biblical texts, like other compositions in the ancient world, were meant to be understood. They at one time made sense, so it would be my responsibility to make the most convincing sense I could of the very difficult and challenging language and text of Job. I would have to treat the book of Job like any other ancient Near Eastern text I had tackled, as though it had been unearthed only yesterday. Of course, the text of Job has been around for about 2,500 years. There have been traditions of interpreting it. However, it is clear from the first known attempts to understand Job, the Aramaic translation or Targum from Qumran among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Old Greek translation, which were written over 200 years after Job was given something like its present form, that much of Job was misunderstood, even in the centuries close to the time of its composition. There is no unbroken chain of interpretation that can be accessed. There are only efforts by ancient, medieval, and modern interpreters to get a handle on its sometimes stupefying language and its out-of-the-box ideas. My studies in Job, spanning close to half a century, have ultimately led me to understandings that differ significantly from those that have prevailed and continue to prevail. And I will say, especially in these halls, right, that I was privileged to have a year's study of the book of Job with Professor H.L. Ginsberg of this institution in 1972-73. And because I regard Job as a very great expression of the human spirit, it matters to me that the book be understood as responsibly as possible. It is toward that end that I have translated Job in order to make a difference in how this astonishing work is read and interpreted. Okay. Now, if you'll take in hand the handout. So we can't obviously go through the whole translation or all of the themes and topics in Job, but what we can do is to look at a few of them. And so the first theme I would like to look at is that of basing your knowledge on experience, which includes revelation, which is what we find in the case of Job. Right? His arguments are based on his own personal tragic experience and on a revelation that he had, and we'll see in a minute that it's Job's revelation, versus tradition, convention, right? And Job's companions base themselves basically on textbook theology, what they've been taught, right, what they've learned from their ancestors. In the middle of what the way I regard it as his first speech, Job says the following. You can follow on the handout. Why give light to one in travail, or life to those bitter of spirit, those waiting for death, but there is none, though they dig for it more than for treasure, those singing for joy at the mouth of the tomb, who are glad to be reaching the grave? Why give light to a man whose path is hidden from Eloah, who screens him off from his sight? I've given you there the Hebrew because I translate a little differently from most people, but the reason I do that is because it's clear that the phrase, asher darko nistara, that is, whose path is hidden, is based on Isaiah 40:27, right? And I'm translating here. You can see the Hebrew. I'm translating from a different translation from the New Jewish Publication Society, just so you know that I'm not, you know, cheating so much, right? Why do you say, O Jacob, why declare, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my cause is ignored by my God? Okay? It's not that Job can't see his own way, it's that God is closing him off from God's sight because he doesn't want to know what's going on, and if God doesn't know what's happening to Job or to other people who suffer, then God can't be responsible for or expected to help them, to rescue them. Okay. I'm going to continue now in Job's speech. For my moans come to me like my bread, and my growls are doled out like my water. A fear I have feared, and it's come about. Just what I dreaded befell me. I've had no rest, I've had no quiet, I've had no repose. Restlessness comes. Now, verse 25 that we just read, a fear I have feared. What's the fear? What's the fear? And, you know, commentators have a lot of difficulty trying to, was it something that happened before? Was it something that's going to happen, etc.? But it's pretty clear because the theme of the fear is picked up in the middle of chapter 4. And that's where Job's speech continues, because the two halves of chapter 4 are in the wrong order, right? The first half is in one place, the second half in another place, like the pages were interchanged when the papyrus roll fell apart and they glued it back together in the wrong order, or because a scribe, you know, was copying and skipped and then realized, uh-oh, I forgot. And then what scribes did in ancient times, you would think they would just erase or something, but that's not what they did. Sometimes that's what they did, but very often what they did was they just continued. In other words, they copy, they realize, oh, I skipped something. They just copy it in the next available space. You know, you might think that that's, you know, not the way it should be done, but that's the way that ancient scribes worked for the most part, right? That's the way they worked. Okay, and there's evidence for that, which I won't go into now. Okay, what I'm going to show you, though, is internal evidence that this hair-raising revelation has to be Job's, because it's quoted back to Job by two of his companions, by Eliphaz and by Bildad, and I'm going to show you that in a minute. Okay, so the fear that Job feared. Now we're looking toward the bottom of page 1, where it says chapter 4, verses 12 to 14. Yet to me did a word come in stealth, and my ear grasped the hint of it, in shudders from visions in the night, when slumber falls upon people. Fear overcame me, and trembling, as shivers set my bones to shaking. For a spirit passed across my face. It set the hair of my flesh on end. It stood still, but I could not discern its demeanor, nor the form in front of my eyes. A moaning and a voice did I hear. That's the Kol Dmama reference from God's revelation to Elijah. Okay, and here's what the voice said. I hope you're following. This is a spirit, a member of the divine assemblage, right, of angels, one of the spirits I call the rogue spirit, right, who reveals to Job something that is not supposed to be revealed from the divine council. Can a mortal be righteous before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? In other words, human beings are all deficient. That's point number one, right? If in his servants he puts no trust, and in his angels he finds fault. In other words, don't be surprised, God doesn't find the angels to be so good either. Right? So if the angels aren't good in God's eyes, all the more so are human beings deficient in God's eyes. Right? Then all the more those who dwell in clay houses whose foundation is in the dust. And of course, who are the people whose foundation is in the dust, etc.? Human beings, because we're made from the dust, Genesis chapter 2. Okay. They are quashed before twilight, from daybreak till evening they are crushed. When it's not even nightfall, they forever disappear. I've given you the Hebrew of that. I'm not going to go into it. But, you know, thanks to the genius of Professor Ginsberg, these lines make a lot of sense that they didn't make so well before him. Okay, verse 21. Their tenpin, that is human beings' tenpin, is pulled up on them. They die without ever finding knowledge. Okay, so people have short lives, and they never really get it. Right, and that's it. And that's what Job learns from the rogue spirit. So he shouldn't be so surprised, right, you know, that he suffers or that he might be afflicted. You know, maybe not for nothing he really did wrong, but for the fact of being human. Okay. Now his friend Eliphaz responds to this. And he says in chapter 5, verse 1, call out now. Does anyone answer you? To whom of the holy ones can you turn? He's mocking him for having listened to the angels. Right? The holy ones are the angels. Right? But if Eliphaz was the one who in the Masoretic text, in the traditional text, if he's the one who had this revelation, how could he be mocking, you know, someone who claims to have heard from the angels? No, it's clear that this is Job's revelation, and Eliphaz is mocking, but that's not the end of it, not by a long shot. And then Job says, chapter 6, verse 10, yet would I have this one consolation, when I'd writhe and recoil, as he'd show no mercy, that I did not conceal the words of the Holy One. And here, Holy One is used not of God, but of the angels, the way that it is everywhere else in the book of Job. The epithet Holy One is hardly ever used of God in the Bible. Okay, those people who say, oh, this is clearly God, and most translators think that, they just haven't checked very much. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, Eliphaz. Okay, now Eliphaz in chapter 15, right, cannot be understood unless you know that it was Job who had this revelation and that Eliphaz is mocking it. And I'm not even pulling a lot of fast ones here in chapter 15. This is, most of what I'm reading is found in the regular translations. But what they've done, you see, is not to put two and two together and make sense. And my claim is that it always makes sense. There are arguments back and forth, and the arguments back and forth are to each other, and they make sense. Even though they're arguing past each other on a certain level, they're also answering each other and using language used by the previous speakers. Okay, so in the middle of the second page of the handout, Eliphaz says, 15, does a sage utter such windy speech and fill his belly with an east wind? In other words, Job, you're a blowhard. I can't buy anything you're saying. Arguing a case to no advantage with words that bring no benefit. You go so far as to abrogate piety and expropriate talk from the presence of El. The second line here is interpreted by other people differently, simply because they don't understand that Job is has claimed to have this revelation from the from divine being. But if you look at the Hebrew, you'll see that my translation is exactly what it says, and that other translations are not what it says. It's as simple as that. Alter comes a little bit closer to the first part. So you thwart reverence, take away prayer to God. The take away part is good, betigra. But prayer to God, sicha lifnei el, I don't think so. Not in biblical Hebrew. Okay, so I'm continuing. Verses 5 and 6. For your own mouth denounces your crime as you adopt a devious tongue. Your own mouth condemns you, not I. Your own lips testify against you. Okay, what is this crime that he's spoken? Well, he's going to explain it. Are you the first human to have been born? Were you engendered before the hills? Well, why would it be relevant to bring this up at this point in the argument? Only if Job had claimed to know something about God that's esoteric, that nobody else knows. Because the only time that God reveals God's self in the wisdom literature of the Bible, right, is at the time of creation. Look at Proverbs 8 when you have time. Proverbs 8, the second part. Okay, it's quite clear. God uses wisdom to create the world. That's when God reveals God's self. Job wasn't around then. So if Job wasn't around then, he couldn't really know, right, what the secrets about God. So Eliphaz, the first and eldest, apparently, of the friends, denies that Job had such a revelation. And that's where his own mouth denounces him, that he's making a claim that isn't true. Verse 8, have you been listening in the divine counsel, expropriating wisdom to yourself? Well, that's exactly what it says, right? He says exactly that. And yet people, again, I'm telling you, don't put two and two together. But if you're looking to find sense in Job from one chapter to the other, then you have to make sure that you're reading everything in the right place, and so that the things all do connect, and they do. You just have to make an adjustment now and then, and not a real lot. Okay, verse 9 and 10. What do you know that we don't know, that you understand but not intelligible to us? With us are the gray-haired and the aged, greater in years than your father. In other words, this is the crux of the argument for Eliphaz. Right? Job can't have special knowledge, more knowledge about God than they do, because they're older. They've got more years. And if they're older, you see, the longer you live, the more you know. Right? Of course, younger people, you know, feel that, you know, they sometimes know better than we. You know, but we older people, we know better. You know? No. Okay. Eliphaz may be right about that sometimes. But on the other hand, against Job, right, he can't say, you know, you, Job, aren't speaking about what the reality is, because Job has suffered, right? And he's a righteous man, and everybody knows it. And so he's basing himself on his experience as well as on this revelation. But Eliphaz can't cope with it. He can't grapple with the profundity of Job's suffering. Verse 11, are the consolations of these men too few for you? Other translators understand the word El there to be God, but it can't be God in this particular context for a very simple reason. God has never consoled Job. There isn't any consolation of Job. Therefore, El has to be the short form of Elet, which is found a couple of times in the book of Genesis, elsewhere in the book of Job, but it's not an oddity. Okay, are the consolations of these men too few for you, that you claim to have a secret word, v'davar la'at imach, which is exactly that meaning? And you can look at another translation and see how they understood it. But if you know Hebrew, I think you'll agree, right, that, you know, without any other preconceptions, v'davar la'at imach means a word came to you, you know, quietly, stealthily, secretly. Okay, verses 12, 13, how your heart carries you away, and how haughty are your eyes, that you answer El with your wind, and out of your mouth put forth such words. And now it's a direct quotation from Job. This is an introduction to a direct discourse. And I not only am I theorizing this, but if you read chapter 8 in Job, in the speech of Bildad, which I've given you in translation there, but you can check the Hebrew, okay, in verse 10, right, he introduces the direct discourse. He's quoting Proverbs, you know, certain Proverbs, not from the book of Proverbs, but some wise sayings, some adages, some epigrams. They will surely instruct you, that is the elders. They'll tell you, out of their hearts they will utter words. And these are the words. It's almost the exact same formula that we find in chapter 15 and 13, when Eliphaz says, and out of your mouth put forth such words. And now, what's the quotation? Verses 14 to 16 on the left-hand margin, middle of page 3. What is a mortal that he be rendered pure, that a man born of a woman be found right? Same point as the rogue spirit made in chapter 4, right, which is, right, that human beings can't be good enough in God's eyes. Second point, if he puts no trust in his holy ones, there you got the holy ones, the angels, and the heavens are not pure in his eyes, heavens are parallel to the angels because the stars were considered to be angelic beings in some contexts, and the heavens are not pure in his eyes, that's point number two, the angels aren't good enough. All the more, one detested and depraved who drinks corruption as though it were water, which of course is a parody of the third point, which is that Job had reported only that human beings are made of dust and dirt, right? But Eliphaz, parodying Job, makes the point even more extreme, that human beings are detested and depraved, etc. Okay. Now, Bildad, friend number two, in the third round of debate, there are three rounds of debate. In the third round, Bildad says the following. And here I have to put together two chapters, 25 and 26, taking pieces of this one, and they're like pieces of a puzzle. You just have to arrange them in the right order. But that's easy. That's much easier than, you know, than understanding that the second half of chapter 4 belongs to Job. Here it's very easy because, you know, sir, there are marks. There are rhetorical markings in the text. If somebody is speaking to someone in the singular, it's a friend speaking to Job. If Job is speaking to his friends, he's speaking to them in the plural. That's easy. Okay, so that already helps you with half of restoring this, the right sequence in chapters 25 and 26. And the rest of it is simply that there is an introduction to direct discourse, he quotes, and then you have a quote. And the quote is the one that we already know. And the introduction to direct discourse you're going to see in a minute. Okay, so now I'm reading the restored sequence, right, which is, again, easy. And you should also know that lots of scholars, right, make similar kinds of reconstructions, especially in this part of the book of Job in the mid-20s. Right, this is not the most radical or unusual thing that I've done, except that in my translation, of course, I put everything in the right order because, again, the book makes sense. I want people to be able to read a translation of Job. And of course, I would love it if people could also read it along with the Hebrew. But I'd love it if people would, you know, understand it to make sense. Okay. So Bildad, towards the bottom of page 3, how do you offer help without power? How do you save with an arm lacking strength? How do you give counsel without wisdom, imparting so much sage knowledge? Whose words are you revealing? Whose breath comes forth from you? Okay, that's a pretty clear introduction to direct discourse. Whose breath comes forth from you? He's quoting. Who's behind these words? And now what does he say? How can a mortal be righteous before God? How can a man born of woman be innocent? Point number one, human beings are deficient. Point number two, if the moon cannot shine brightly enough and the stars are not pure in his eyes, right? These are the celestial objects that are parallel to or equivalent to, in some way, the angels. Okay, so that's point number two. The angels aren't good enough. Moon can't shine brightly enough. Then all the less a mortal, a maggot, all the less a son of a human, a worm, which of course is even an even more extreme way of putting down humanity. Okay, so with this example, I think I've tried to show, right, that one of the arguments between Job and his friends is not just about the problem of why are there innocent people who suffer, but rather how do you base your knowledge? Do you base it on experience, which includes revelation, or do you base it on what we've learned in textbooks, right? What everybody knows, what we thought we knew. And his friends are not able to change their theological views, right? The catechism, you might say, that they grew up with on the basis of new evidence in the form of Job's predicament. Okay. Second theme that I want to look at with you is Job's lawsuit against God. Now, Job, of course, wants to know why he's suffering, right? And he is assuming that God's punishing him for something, but for the life of him, he can't figure out what it is. So therefore, he's got to compel God to reveal the charges against him. How does he do this? He does this by suing God, right? An actual lawsuit. Many scholars see this as a metaphor. This is no metaphor. He tries to sue God. In the same way that at the very beginning of his speech, Job tries to eliminate the day of his birth. Well, you can't really do that. It's surreal. But that's the thing. When life becomes too painful, when the real is unbearable, you turn to the surreal. And that's exactly what Job does. He is now ready to sue God. And the funny thing is, it works. That is, God in the end appears and answers the lawsuit in a certain way. I'm not sure we'll have time to talk about that certain way, but in the question period afterwards, if you like, we can discuss it. Okay. So, Job says, now bringing up his lawsuit. First, he just toys with the idea of suing God. Then he decides, well, I have nothing to lose. I'm going to do it. So, top of page 4, right, Job 13:13. He says to his friends, keep silent before me so that I may speak. Whatever may come upon me, I will take my flesh in my teeth. I will place my life breath in my hand. Though he, God, slay me, I will no longer wait. I will accuse him of his ways to his face. You can read the footnote if you're not happy with what I did with that verse. Okay, verse 16. Only he can be my salvation, for he would allow no blasphemer to approach. Hear, yes, hear my words, my declaration with your ears. Look here, I am laying out my lawsuit. I know I am in the right. Who would argue the case with me? I would then keep silent and expire. If only God would just appear and tell me what the problem is. Only two things you must not do to me, he says to God. Then I will not hide from your face. Put your hand far from upon me and terrify me not with your awesome mien. Either you summon and I will respond, or I will speak and you will answer me. How many are my crimes and my sins, my transgression and my sin? Tell me what they are. Okay, so this is his challenge to God, right? I'm suing you, but if you want to start, okay, you bring the charges, I'll answer them. Otherwise, I will lay forth my charges and you answer. And he continues, this is in a later speech in Job 23. If he, God, would let me know how to find him, I would come before his seat. I won't wait for God to come to me, I'll go to him. I just don't know where he is. I would lay before him my lawsuit and fill my mouth with accusations. I would know the words he would answer me and discern what he would say to me. Would he argue with me by force of might? No, he would make his own case against me. There the upright would have a hearing with him, and I would truly get my day in court. Okay, now the second line is translated very differently by almost everybody in a kind of nebbishy way, I have to say. And it doesn't really mean much the way that other people translate it. And it's, and if you look at the Hebrew and look at the English, you know, you'll be surprised. Then, you know, the how the Hebrew is really, you know, conveyed in that English. However, here I did what I did in a number of places, and it took me a long time to finish this translation, partly because, look, I'm not a genius like Ginsberg. It took me a long time to let things sit in my head until various connections came through. And maybe, you know, many other people would have made these connections faster than I, but fortunately I didn't turn in my manuscript until I had made enough of the connections. Right? And in this case, it's an easy one once you see it. And that is, okay, when he says, no, he would make his own case against me. That's God. That's the Hebrew of that is Habarov Koach Yarivi Madi. Would he argue with me by force of might? Lo Ahu Yasimbi. And what does Yasimbi to literally to set against me? What does to set against me mean? Okay, so various there are I've given you a couple of other translations of this, but now I will give you the right translation, which is simply that this is an abbreviation of the full expression. And the full expression is introduced earlier in the book in chapter 5, verse 8, in the speech of Eliphaz. And here I am indebted, we're all indebted, to Professor Shalom Paul, who was my teacher of Bible my first year here in the seminary in the mid-1960s, taught here for several years before moving to Israel. And he wrote an article in the late 1970s that explains the meaning of this expression in 5:8. Rather, Eliphaz says, I wouldn't, you know, turn to any of the angels. I would seek out El, God. Before Elohim would I lodge my complaint. Ulam ani edrosh El, the El Elohim, lots of alliteration there. Right? Asim divrati, I would set my divra. The word divra is in this context, right, unique. And why the way that you say a legal case or a litigation or lawsuit in biblical Hebrew, you can say mishpat, but you also can say davar. Just davar in the masculine. Very simply, that's the regular word for a legal case. It's used all over the place. Okay, here you have the form divra. Why a feminine form which doesn't occur elsewhere in this sense, anywhere else in the Tanakh? Well, it's because it's based on Akkadian awata shakanu, to lodge a legal complaint. And awata is the regular word meaning davar in Akkadian, except that it's feminine, not masculine. And so under the influence of that calc, that borrowed expression, sim divra is to lodge a legal complaint, and a regular complaint or a legal complaint in the Hebrew of the book of Job. So, seem then to lasim be in Job 23, verse 6, lo ahu yasim be, right? He would make his own case against me, is just an abbreviation of yasim divra be, which explains then also the preposition, which is mistranslated else, you know, by others, I have to say. Okay, there, but how do I know that I'm interpreting correctly? How do I know that that's an abbreviation? Because the same abbreviated expression occurs in the speeches of the fourth friend, Elihu, who suddenly appears in chapter 32. And Elihu uses exactly this expression in the exact context that makes it clear. Okay, so let's just look at Elihu chapter 34, verses 21-22. For his, that's God's, eyes are trained on the ways of a man, and all of his steps he sees. There is no darkness or deathly shade where workers of evil can hide. Thus a man should no more make a case. Ki lo al ish yasim, in parentheses divra, od, to enter a lawsuit with El, lahaloch el El b'mishpat. The second line makes very clear what the first line is about. Seem is an expression meaning to bring a legal case, right? And it's based on 5:8, and it's abbreviated by Job in chapter 23, and it's abbreviated here by Elihu in a clearer context. And the point is that because Job is bringing a lawsuit against God, one of the things that Elihu advises him is to drop the lawsuit. Drop the lawsuit. It's not going to be healthy for you to try to sue God. All right, that's something from the Job's lawsuit. Of course, there's a lot more that one could add to that whole skein of argument, but we're going to move on to the last theme that I'll present this evening, and that is Job's responses to God. All right, Elie Wiesel, in the several pieces that he wrote about Job, said that he was very disappointed in Job because he never should have capitulated to God. He never should have, taken his words back, etc. Well, if he had read John Curtis's article from 1979, or had read things that I wrote later on and was using my translation, he would understand that Job doesn't take anything back and Job doesn't capitulate. Job is defiant until the very end. Okay, and now we're going to see how that works. But it's not just in the second response to God, but it's also in his first response. When God appears, God divides the speech into two parts. And many people wonder, why two parts? So, of course, biblical scholars very often say, well, second part was added later, written by somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe. But I don't think there's any way of really, demonstrating that argument. But rather, God makes an answer to Job, which is to basically to throw out Job's case because Job wasn't there at the time of creation, and therefore he doesn't know about God, and therefore he can't bring a suit against God, and therefore he has no standing in the court. So I don't have to answer you. You have no standing. You're out. All right. That's the legal implication of God's speech. Nevertheless, after the first speech, Job makes a response. And this is also not properly understood, but I think now we can understand it. And again, without any funny business. Okay. Chapter 40, verses 4 to 5. Job says, lacking respect, hen kaloti, which is usually interpreted a different way. See, I am so humble, I am of small account. But kaloti doesn't have to mean that. Okay, it can mean lacking respect. Hen kaloti. How can I answer you? Ma'ashiveka. My hand I place over my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not repeat. Here I read slightly differently from the Hebrew, not eneh, but eshneh, a verb that's used elsewhere in Job. I will not repeat. I will not do it a second time. I'm not alone in reading that there. It's not so unusual. I have spoken once and I will not repeat. Twice and I will speak no more. Okay? Now, what is the business of putting the hand over the mouth? So many people, those who expect that God would have thrown, Job overboard, so to speak, if Job had not taken back all of his complaints, right? They think that when Job puts his hand over his mouth, right, it's that he's silencing himself. Well, that's not what this expression means. You can just check. Right? It occurs several times in the Bible, occurs in Samuel, etc., but it occurs two other places in the book of Job. One of them you could argue about, the other one I don't think you can. It's very clear what it means. Let's look at the bottom of page 5 on the handout. For Job 21:5, he says to his friends, face me and be still, and set your hands over your mouths. Why does he want them to set their hands over their mouths? Not to quiet themselves, but he says, be still. Why? He wants them to listen to him. Putting the hand over the mouth is a gesture that means I'm listening. To ask someone to put their hands over their mouths is to say, you stop talking. It's my turn to speak. And if you're not convinced by that case, let's look at Job in chapter 29, where he engages in a certain reverie about the good old days. The good old days when God was in his corner, so to speak. When God was blessing him and he was a very well-recognized and respected figure in his town. So Job says, when I would go out to the city gate, take my seat in the public square, young men would see me and withdraw, and the old would rise and stand. Right? So even young people would respect him and withdraw. Job is a funny. He's going to say something. Let's see what he has to say. Right? The old people would rise and stand. Right? They don't have to. Their seats are for the old. Right? Princes would hold back their words, placing a hand over their mouths. Why are they placing hands over their mouths? They haven't said anything. They can't take back anything. They're not speaking. They're placing their hands over their mouths as a sign of respect to Job, right? We will be quiet. We want to hear what you have to say. Okay. Leaders would stifle their voices, their tongues clinging to their palates. When an ear would hear me, it would affirm. And when an eye would see me, it would attest. So this is what it's all about, right? Job is saying to God, I put my hand over my mouth. Why? Because I've asked you for something. I've asked for something that I think is reasonable. What do you have against me? And God hasn't answered. And so he wants to hear more. So after the first speech, where he hasn't heard an answer, he puts his hand over his mouth, and he waits for a second answer. And then God gives another answer. And God trots out these two semi-mythological beings, right, or animals. Like, one is like the hippopotamus, one is like a crocodile, but they're made of some inanimate material. You know, they're, you know, like science fiction. Right, and even a god it would be terrified of them, says God. They're terrifying, and this is God. These are God's exhibits that God trots out to show how God is the creator of the world. I think it requires a lot of thought, right? To ponder those examples. In any case, how does Job respond to all this? Chapter 42, verse 2. The first part is parody, and I think to appreciate what I have done in the wake of John Curtis's article from the late 70s, what I have done here is based on understanding the first part as parody. Okay, so Job says, I have known you are able to do well. Now, God, you haven't shown me anything new. You've got a lot of power? I know. I have known you are able to do well. That you cannot be blocked from any scheme. That phrase, you cannot be blocked from any scheme, is a parody of Genesis 11:6. Okay, there's a misprint in my book. Corrected for when the third printing comes out. Okay, in any case, if you look at two-thirds down the page, Genesis 11:6b, nothing that they, God is saying this of the builders of the Tower of Babel, nothing that they propose to do, Yazamu, will be out of their reach. Lo yi batzer min. Those are the expressions. And of course, what is the expression that's being used by Job? Lo yi batzer mehem kol mezima, which is almost exactly the same language. Almost exactly the same language. So God is speaking, I'm sorry, Job is speaking of God in terms that God used about these builders of the Tower of Babel, whom he completely derogates. And so, to see that this is a praise of God, I think, is stretching the sense. Okay, and then Job quotes God from the whirlwind speech. And if you read, as I did, Simon Dentist's book on parody, you will see that mimicry is the very quintessence of parody, right? You say, good evening, and I say, good evening, right? You just change a nuance, you change something about it, but it's basically the same. So what Job does is now to quote God. Who is this hiding counsel without knowledge? And Job says, truly I've spoken without comprehending, wonders beyond me that I do not know. You can take this either at face value, or you can understand it as Job's tongue-in-cheek, right, answer to God, right, who is this hiding counsel? Yeah, I know. I didn't know what I was talking about. Okay, whatever you say. And then he quotes God again. Hear now and I will speak. I will ask you and you help me know. And Job says, as a hearing by the ear, I have heard you. And now my eye has seen you. Now, many people make a big deal about how this is expressing the fact that Job has now had a special revelation of God that he never enjoyed before. However, this is exactly what Job says in chapter 13, verse 1, which you can check. Right? He says exactly that. My eye has seen it. I know it. There's nothing new here. There's nothing new here for Job. And this is what he feared all along, that God would be all about power and would not be about justice. And that's exactly what God shows him in the God speeches. If you read the Elihu speeches first, Then there's a concern for human beings, there's a concern for God educating humans, there's divine providence, right? There's concern, but somebody put the Elihu speeches in before the speeches of God, in, because they realized that God doesn't show all of these concerns and justice and concern for human beings in the God speeches. In fact, what is the biggest reward for obeying the Torah in the Torah? You get your rain in its due season. We just prayed for it not long ago in Israel. Got a little bit of rain. Okay, that's the biggest reward. What does God say in chapter 38? I make it rain where nobody lives. How is that an affirmation of the principle of, you know, reward for doing good? Okay, in any case, what does Job say in the end? That is why I am fed up. I take pity on dust and ashes. And I have to say that, you know, in the discussions of my book, you know, reviews of the book that have appeared so far, this is what almost everybody latches onto, and I can see why. Okay, but I didn't do any funny business here. I didn't interpret any phrase differently from the way that it should be or can be interpreted. And in fact, I would argue this is the only way it really can be interpreted without stretching the meaning of any of the phrases. Right, the first phrase, I'm going to just go through it very quickly. Right, the first phrase is, he said, giving you the Hebrew in the middle of the page, Al-Kain Em-As, right? That is why Em-As, which means in biblical Hebrew, I reject, or it can mean I reject myself, I abhor myself, and it can mean I am fed up. It's like nimas li in modern Hebrew. And how do I know that it, everybody or many people say it requires an object? It does not require an object. There are seven times in the Bible it occurs without an object. And one of them prominently in the book of Job, look at chapter 7, 16, which is two-thirds down the page. Ma'asti in 7:16, translated not by me, but by the New Jewish Publication Society, the translation, the Tanakh. They translate the same, almost exactly the same form, ma'asti, not emas, but it, in biblical poetry, it has exactly the same meaning. I am sick of it. I am sick of it. And I translate, of course, as I do in 42:6, I'm fed up. Okay, so the first phrase means I'm fed up. Those people who think it means to recant, they're the ones who are stretching everything by adding words that aren't there. They understand it as emas divarai or something like that. I'm taking back my words. That's an expression that doesn't occur anywhere in the Bible. They made the whole thing up. How do you know there was such an expression? They don't know. They don't have any basis on which to make that claim. Okay, so they're imagining things because it's the way they would like the book to end. It's the way that traditionally people have understood Job. You know, how could it be in the Bible if Job wasn't pious? How could God praise Job's way of speaking if Job was to speak this way? Nevertheless, this is what it means, and this is what it says, and we'll see the rest. V'nichamti al. Nichamti al can mean two different things in biblical Hebrew, right? It can mean either I take pity on, or it can mean I regret. Okay, it could mean one of those two things. Okay, let's hold on to that for a second. Afar va'efer. Afar va'efer is a biblical phrase, dust and ashes. And dust and ashes is used two other times in the Bible. One by Abraham when he says, I am but dust and ashes, when he comes to bargain with God about the fate of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And once in Job where he says that God has thrown me down to the earth and I am like dust and ashes. In both of these places, right, dust and ashes is not literal. It's a figurative expression that means abject humanity. And so, based on two other passages with no other, right, conflicting evidence, I would understand afar va'efer here to mean, right, abject humanity, dust and ashes. Okay, so can you say I repent on dust, on abject humanity? No. You can say, however, I take pity on dust and ashes, which is exactly what you find in, for example, it's used a few times this way, in Psalm 90:13, right, toward the bottom of the page, Shuv Hashem ad matai v'hinachem al avadecha. And this is not my translation, I'll translate, this is the way the New Jewish Publication Society translates, Turn, O Lord, how long? show mercy to your servants. Show mercy, have pity, have compassion. Right? That's the way they understand the phrase there. Plus, let's take the whole phrase together in the liturgy of the evening service of Yom Kippur, right, in the Kol Nidre service. There we find this particular phrase, Tinachem al afar va'efer, may you take pity on dust and ashes. What do they mean by that? They mean exactly what Job means, V'nichamti al afar va'efer, I take pity on dust and ashes, humanity. And that's exactly what we ask for, right, on evening of Yom Kippur, may you take pity on dust and ashes. And I'll just, my last, very last point, right, I'll just say that those people who translate differently, I'm recanting in dust and ashes, I repent in dust and ashes, something like that, they didn't bother to check whether you could say that in biblical Hebrew. I never found anyone who checked it, but I did. I was trained by David Marcus. You have to check everything. Okay, so what I checked, right, was can you say to, you know, to be doing something in dust and ashes? No, you have to say, I'm repenting or whatever. Sitting in dust and ashes, lying in dust and ashes, crawling in dust and ashes, etc. You need a verb of being in the dust and ashes. Then you could say, I'm repenting, recanting, or something like that. But you can't just have that. It would be an extremely odd Hebrew usage, right? There are like 20 cases of repenting either in the dust or on the ground. I checked all of these out. If you find an exception, I'd appreciate it if you'd let me know. I'm really ready to correct myself if I made a mistake. But in this case, I think I checked it pretty carefully. In any case, the point is that in the end, right, Job stands on his own. And the reason he does, and this is my last sentence in the presentation, the reason he does is because he has one fault. He is completely honest. Right? He's completely honest. He has to see things, he has to tell things exactly the way he sees them. And if he has a fault, it's that he has to say to God and to everyone exactly what he believes to be true. Whether it's true or not, he believes it is true. Thank you. Okay, I am fielding the questions. Okay, nice to see you, Michael. Thank you.
So, I've heard for many years from you and from Mayor Gruber.
Do you stand up, please?
Yeah.
I've heard for many years from you and from Mayor Gruber that the second half of chapter 4 belongs in the Mount of Job. But I didn't understand until this presentation tonight how important that is in the sort of plot of the book, because Job makes this claim and then Eliphaz goes ballistic. And at the end of the book, there's a second revelation about which there's no question. Also at the beginning of the book.
And made to Job.
Right.
Right.
But at the beginning of the book, there's a revelation to us, the characters. And I'm wondering now what you would say about sort of the plot of the book of Job in that direction.
Oh, thank you. Okay. What Michael Karasik, who is responsible for the wonderful English editions of the Mikra Gedolot, published by Jewish Publication Society. So Michael is asking about the fact that at the beginning of the book, right, we know that the reason that Job is suffering is that God is challenging the Satan, right? To recognize this one kind of perfect man, right, who is faithful to God and does only right and good, God's just proud of him. And the Satan says, well, it's only because you give him lots of rewards and blessings. Take those away and he will curse you. And God is ready to take on that challenge. And he says, okay, you can afflict anything, you can affect anything that belongs to him. And that's what happens. And then Job adheres to his piety. And then the same scene repeats. And the Satan says, well, you've got to actually affect Job himself, right? If you really want to see if Job will curse you, you have to hurt Job on his own person. Okay? And so God says, okay, you can afflict him, but you have to leave him alive. Okay, so he afflicts him with Shechin Ra, which is the Shechin, remember, one of the plague of boils, Shechin Ra, terrible skin inflammation, which Joe scratches and suffers from all the time, day and night. Okay, so Joe, so we at the beginning of the book know that Job is being afflicted in order for God to prove a point, or we could put it a different way, in order that God be able to learn, right, how devoted Job is to God. In other words, if I do this to him, will he still love me? If I do that to him, will he still love me? And I have to say, it's a sadistic move. It's a sadomasochistic relationship, which I was the first, I think, to write a whole article about, but I wasn't the first to notice. Okay. In any case, will you still love me? You know, if I hurt you in this way, will you still love me if I hurt you even more? Okay. That's what we find at the beginning of the book, and at the end of the book, right? Job never learns, and his friends never learn what the problem was, why Job was affected. And that, in a sense, that's being hidden from my own. Is this what you're interested in, Michael? Right.
Despite that, I now understand the rest of the book, it's the poem is framed by Revelation.
Yes. Yes. Well, we don't. So Job and his friends never know. They never know. But we know, and that I think is something to ponder, right? Why wouldn't God let Job and his friends know? I mean, I think, you know, the simple answer is, well, it's kind of fable, and it's important that we know, and it doesn't matter so much, you know, what it's like at the ending of the book of Jonah. You know, we don't really care if Jonah is convinced, that God's compassion is justified. It matters if we believe it. It doesn't matter if Job is convinced at the end. Jonah is convinced at the end. I'm sorry. Okay. Yes.
I'm a complete amateur, and perhaps I didn't hear you correctly, but I have a question about one of the sentences here on the first page. I don't know who him and his refers to.
Oh.
Okay,
thank you. Yes. Okay. Yes, I read kind of quickly through, and I can understand why it's hard to follow. In the book itself, I give in the footnotes there are some guidance. Right? There are some marks of along the trail. Okay. Why should light be given? Right? Why give light? He doesn't mention God there. To a man whose path is hidden from Eloah, God. Okay? So why should a man have to live a life when God isn't actually watching that life to be able to protect it, et cetera, et cetera? Who screens him off from his sight? That's referring to Eloah. God screens him, the man, off from his, God's, sight. You know, it's... Job develops this idea later in the book, and you can tell that I'm interpreting it correctly because Eliphaz in chapter 22 elaborates Job's point, quoting it directly back to Job's via Marta. You said, you, Job, claim that God is high in the heavens, and that because of that, God is behind the clouds. God can't see what happens to human beings. Therefore, God can't come to people's aid. Right? There's no divine providence. Okay? Because God doesn't know what's really happening to human beings. Eliphaz takes a different point of view, that God is great because God is high in the sky, right? And God sees everything. It's a different point of view. In other words, from God's perch, high in the sky, God can be aware of everything. It's an opposite
point.
Oh, okay, yes. Why don't I capitalize the name of the pronouns for God? Right, he. It would make it clear. I did that when I first started translating, but I realized at the end there isn't any indication like that in Hebrew, and I tried to make my translation as true to the Hebrew as I could. So I used the names of God that are actually used in the book. I didn't use the name for God because God has this association with good, whether it's etymologically correct or not. Right. So I decided I won't call God God. I'll just use the Hebrew names that are used in the book. and I don't capitalize, which happens to be, if I'm not mistaken, it's like a 19th century Christian invention. There may be people who know this better than I. I think even a Mormon invention, right, to capitalize, you know, the pronouns of God's name. In any case, it's not what you find in the Hebrew. And if there's an ambiguity in the Hebrew, I would like to convey that ambiguity to some extent in my translation. And I think that that's an honest translation. You know, that reading my translation may require a little bit of thinking. It may slow you down. But anybody here, even professors of Bible here, even I, right, after all the studies I've done, sitting down with the book of Job open, it's a hard read. It's a very hard read, even for professionals. So, and for the average Hebrew reader, it's even harder. It's almost impossible without a good translation and a commentary, right? And a good commentary. And it's because I didn't find any of the translations or the commentaries to my liking, and also because I wanted to understand the book. I felt the only way I'm going to understand it right is to translate it for myself. So I translated for myself and for others.
One last question.
Okay, Mark.
So first of all, I have to say the beautiful translation is really beautiful.
Thank you.
But one of the question I had running throughout the book is, how did this book ever make it into the canon?
Okay. How did the book of Job, being as radical as it is, make it into the canon? Okay, I'll have a couple of, I've been asked that question before. I'll answer it in a couple of different ways. First of all, the idea of canonization is often thought of as a process of selection. You know, like a group, you know, sat down in a committee and decided, you know, what's appropriate to put in the Bible and what isn't appropriate. I prefer, or I am inclined more to the view of my very senior late colleague Menachem Haran, a well-known biblical scholar, who wrote, he didn't finish his whole project, but he published four Hebrew, dense Hebrew volumes on how the literature of the Bible was composed and transmitted. And his point is that after the Babylonian exile, when they started collecting Hebrew works, anything that looked good that was written in Hebrew, literary works, was included. They weren't editing things out. They were including just about everything in, unless they knew it was very late. So they knew Ben-Sira was late. They knew Maccabees was late. Right? Somebody attached the second half of Daniel, which is from the Maccabean period, to the first part of Daniel, so people thought it was early. Okay. So, but it wasn't that kind of selective process. That's one answer. Another answer is... The second answer is the book of Job is not the most radical text in the Hebrew Bible, right? For those who are ready to be offended, you know, by radical biblical theology, read Psalm 44, right? Psalm 44 says basically, we have been observing the covenant, God. You are the one who is disappointing us. We are slaughtered on your account day by day, right? Why don't you wake up and act on our behalf? To me, that's more radical than anything Job says. And it's not the only text like that. All right, the third and last point I'll make in answer to that question is that, you know, Baruch Hashem, you know, the Bible includes three works of what we call wisdom. And I'm not going to go into the whole question of whether there was really a category of wisdom or not. There are three books of wisdom, right? There's Proverbs, which is very conventional, traditional wisdom. There's Job. There's Kohelet, which is equally radical, but in a different way. There are also a number of Psalms that are wisdom. And of the three books, Proverbs, Job, and Kohelet, two of them are subversive, right? And I take a great pride in that, right, that the Hebrew Bible, right, is ready to confront the difficult questions and to include, right, books that are that raise questions about, that are provocative concerning the covenant and its traditional theology.
The reason we've got to draw this to an end is
despite the fact that there are clearly many questions, is because there needs to be time for purchase of the book. So we've got copies up here, and $15 will do it, cash or check to the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Before you run, let me just add that we're thrilled that you are here, and we invite you back for our coming book talks in December. December 14th, Ed Kaplan of Brandeis will come and speak about his new one-volume biography of Abraham Joshua Heschel. In January, Professor David Roskies will speak about his new book on the Oynik Shabbos archives, which is a wonderful volume. And in February 25th, yours truly will speak about my new book, A History of the Talmud, and then there will be others after that. So please do come back. Thank you for coming.